You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 9th to the 15th of October 2014. My name's Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, books editor Karen Shook and junior reporter John Elms. The future of the Quality Assurance Agency has been cast into doubt after the door was opened to private companies, government agencies and charities to take over much of its work. That's the splash this week. Simon will have more on that in a second. This week's book of the week is The Man Who Thought He Was Napoleon by Laure Mourat. It will form part of Karen's roundup of this week's book section, no doubt. Well, at least I hope it does now that I've said that. And you may have noticed a few articles recently in the THE under the heading Careers Intelligence. This week's features an interview with William Locke, a reader in HE studies at the Institute of Education in London. John Elms will tell us a little bit more about this section and that piece in particular a little later on. But first, Simon, an interesting week for the QAA. A few changes about who might be carrying out its remit, possibly on the horizon.
This is a kind of a surprise announcement that came out this week from the Higher Education Funding Council for England. Basically, inspections of universities in England and in other parts of the UK are obviously carried out by the Quality Assurance Agency. It's done under contract, really, so that HEFCE pay the QAA because HEFCE has a kind of legal duty to make sure that higher education is of a certain standard. So they're the ones that are forced to do it by law, so they pay the QAA to do it. They have a contract with them. I think from memory, it's around about so half of the QAA's income sort of comes from these contracts, basically, this major contract to inspect universities. That may have changed in the last few years. But anyway, what HEFCE has said this week is that it wants to invite other people to bid for that work. Mm. And while that contract is kind of has always been renewed on a kind of annual basis, periodically, and every 3 years they've kind of reviewed the arrangements. And in the past they've kind of looked at how to do inspections in universities, whether they should change the regime, and spoke to the QAA about it. There's never been really a suggestion that I can remember that, oh, well, we'll see if anyone else can do this work. Mm. So for them to say we're going to ask people to bid for this work as well, and it's going to be a competitive tendering process, it suddenly throws the QAA's kind of existence almost, that might be going a bit far, but basically its role into kind of question.
Yeah, HEFCE said the QAA will continue its current role until 2017-18, but after that, I suppose it's anyone's guess, really. I mean, why might changes be moved?
The QAA obviously has vast experience in inspecting universities. They essentially sort of, it's done on a reviewer basis. They hire people to go into do the inspections for them. They don't have staff that do this. They kind of hire people to do it. The QAA is basically the organisation that runs the whole operation. But it may be that, you know, I can't. It's very hard to see other people coming along and having that amount of experience. It may be that the QAA carries on. It might be this is a shot across its bows, really, to say, look, we want to make sure that we our quality assurance sort of, and the way we do it now is up to scratch. Students expect a lot more since NICK fees, so we're going to shake things up a bit, or at least have some sort of process and make sure you work for your money, basically, and actually put in a proper bid. It might be that QAA carries on doing it, but it is like a bit of a kind of shock tactic. I mean, there have been instances in the last few years where the QAA's ability to uphold standards have been called into question. I mean, there was a major inquiry by a group of MPs about five or six years ago, where, you know, there were questions were raised then about whether the QAA was kind of fit for purpose, essentially.
Yeah, we've got a number of experts writing in this piece, which is actually penned by Jack Grove, who's unable to join us now. But one of those experts, Geoffrey Alderman, Professor of Politics and History at the University of Buckingham, he's quoted as saying there's been scandal after scandal on the QAA's watch. On the QAA's watch, So one has to ask whether the QAA is getting value for money. So it's these kind of questions, I guess, that might be why.
Yeah, I mean, on the other
hand, has been called into question.
I mean, on the other side of the coin, you know, it's quite easy to point out things that maybe have gone wrong, as other people in the article point out, like Barham Bakandria, former president now of HEPI. You know, he's pointed out that he's done a reasonable job over the years. You know, you have to look at all the kind of, you know, the way it's up, you know, UK higher education is still seen in great esteem around the world, and you could argue that is partly thanks to the QAA.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, is it fair to kind of pick out these examples as saying that the QAA is not doing a good enough job? But, I mean, one thing that comes up time and time again every year is that, okay, while they can go into universities and ensure standards of a certain level, there are still constantly question marks about the comparability of degrees. And whether, you know, how can you tell whether a degree at one university is the same as another? And that's something that we still are struggling to answer, really. And, you know, that is something that keeps cropping up time and time again. And maybe that's part of the reason why they want to look at it. And also, there have been kind of calls for several years that some institutions want a lighter touch regime. They don't want all the bureaucracy. They want, you know, they're deemed to be forming a high standard, they want a long time before their next review, less red tape, and others saying that there should be more inspections on institutions that are risky.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's all part and parcel of maybe trying to see if they can change the system to reflect the changing nature of HE now, really.
Mm. This announcement definitely bring all of that to a head. We'll watch as that story unfolds. No doubt we'll be revisiting that quite a few times in the coming weeks. Elsewhere in the news section this week, a second literary scholar speaks out about the management at the University of Essex. That's following Marina Warner's comments, of course, earlier this year. There's the latest on proposed USS pension scheme reforms and coverage of a legal ruling that would have seen universities publishing the salaries of highly paid professors, but which has been successfully appealed by King's College London and subsequently overturned. That's all in the news section this week, so do check that out. The book section, though, is a little further into the magazine, but no less important for it. Karen, what have we got in there this week?
Well, it's not a bumper crop this week. It's an embarras de richesse.
Wow.
An embarrassment of riches this week. Eminent American scholar of U.S. foreign relations, Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman, is reviewing for us this week. She's reviewing Frank Ninkovich's book, The Global Republic, America's Inadvertent Rise to World Power. I wasn't surprised that she commended the book, but she said that every reader has experienced just such a moment. You finish a book and feel an urgent need to meet the author. Mm-hmm. Over dinner, at breakfast, on the pavement, or stalking the autograph table. So an unusually confessional review. She says it's quite good.
Completely unbiased.
I'm also really pleased to be featuring a book called The Newton Papers, The Strange and True Odyssey of Isaac Newton's Manuscripts by Sarah Dry. It's reviewed for us by Robin Arianrod from Monash University in Australia. This was first brought to our readers' attention in What Are You Reading? By Graham Farmelow. This is the story of the papers of Isaac Newton, most of which were not published until the 20th century, and the meanings of all them are incredibly contested because obviously we're familiar with the core scientific discoveries, theory of gravity, which was the blueprint for modern theoretical physics. But when you look at what he wrote and what he was interested in, there was an awful lot on alchemy, on spirituality. So it raises the issue, our reviewer and the author says, was he a romantic genius? Was he a hardworking scholar? Was he a mean, spiteful man? Or was he driven by religious faith? The story of how these papers came to be in archives are quite interesting. A lot of them were purchased from private owners and donated. John Maynard Keynes was one of the people who did that. So, in fact, although you would assume that a figure that eminent and living that long ago, everything would have been picked over, apparently there's a heck of a lot of it, and it's hard to understand, which is exactly how I feel about physics. Ted Hondrich, extremely eminent philosopher, the Grote Professor Emeritus of the Philosophy of Mind and Logic at UCL, has written what he considers to be his masterwork, Actual Consciousness, his great work that he sees as redefining the study of the theory of mind. We review it this week. Roberto Locatelli at the University of Warwick is considering it for us.
Also, does she agree with his rather grand
I believe
thoughts?
She says it is an audacious venture. You'll have to read the rest to find out. Caleb Scharf's latest book, The Copernicus Complex, Our Cosmic Significance in a Universe of Planets and Probabilities, is reviewed by Kate McPhee, the University of Edinburgh, who's new to our pages. And as you mentioned, our book of the week, The Man Who Thought He Was Napoleon, Toward a Political History of Madness. This is written by Laure Murat, who is a French scholar who is now based at UCLA. The book itself is fascinating, considering whether there was some connection between bouts of madness and political instability, most notably the number of people who thought they were Napoleon around the time of his rise to power and his deposition. And one of the arguments made is that in a time of upheaval where someone could rise, as he did in a very short period of time, from being an obscure Corsican military man to emperor, were his delusions of grandeur any different to the people who suddenly thought that they too might be Napoleon? Murat is an interesting case. Not only eminent, published a number of important works, including on Sylvia Beach, who is the founder of Shakespeare and Company, and her partner. She didn't go to university. I asked her for the author profile, what were you like as an undergraduate? Well, she never was an undergraduate. She left home and became a literary figure, and she went to university age 36. She went to the EHSS and got a diploma, which is the equivalent of an MA, writing a memoir. Then she was going to do a PhD, and when that happened, she got a fellowship at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, and then, bang, offered a job at UCLA. So she says, I became a professor with a PhD who'd never sat in a class and had never been taught herself. I'm afraid I'm the worst case scenario for your readership.
Interesting stuff. Thanks, Karen. Do check all of those out. John, over to you. Careers Intelligence, it's a piece we've been running in the magazine for a fair few weeks now. Mm-hmm. For this week's episode, edition, if you like, you've been speaking to William Locke at the Institute of Education. What have you been talking about?
I have. Well, as you said, yes, this slot has kind of bloomed recently in the magazine. It is a new edition. And I spoke to William specifically about a paper he had written for the Higher Education Academy, which is called Shifting Academic Careers, Implications for Enhancing Professionalism in Teaching and Supporting Learning, mm-hmm. Where he unpicks the different experiences of academics and in the changing landscape of HE, what people's careers are looking like and how to adapt mm-hmm. that in the changing landscape. And specifically, he talked about the fact that in the past, in the academic career, if we take that as an expression, a phrase, people have kind of gone from post to post and not really thought about their employability in the context of what they need to, what roles they should be looking at, what they should do for roles. And he thinks that this is now a core part of the academic career. From those starting out, those in middle careers, even people, later on in their careers, they should also be thinking about it. And so he offered me an insight into that and what he has suggested for academics to consider when going for roles, and also what the academy needs to do for helping academics in professional development, which is broadly what the slot is about. We've covered many different areas of the academy. We don't just cover news. We have to cover what academics themselves are doing mm-hmm. in their jobs and potential careers. So this one was a nice one in the sense that he specifically talked about what academics could do in terms of going to job interviews and what they should be doing in their careers.
Yeah, it's a good section of some sort of real hands-on tips. Just a few other topics we've had in that section that you'll find online. Tips for developing PhD research questions, the timing of student work placements, writing a research proposal for Horizon 2020, how to get published, quite a big one, I imagine, detecting plagiarism. So if you do look on our site, there is a Careers Intelligence section there where all of those pieces are archived. That's all for this week's Issue Review podcast. There is a standalone TI CHE World University Rankings podcast available online now. The results came out last week. There's also several more podcasts on the horizon, so do keep an eye on that section. We've got quite a few things coming out in the next few weeks. Before I go, I should tell you about our cover feature this week. It asks if it's time for a shake-up of the social sciences. Amanda Goodall and Andrew Oswald conclude that researchers in stagnant, silo-bound subjects do not address mankind's most pressing issues and that the disciplines need a makeover. So do check that out on page 34 as well. But that's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.